I'm Judd McCullum. I found a mammoth tusk, and this is the Prairie Farm Podcast.
I'm Doug Duren, a landowner trying to be a conservationist.
I'm Tabitha Panis, president of the Iowa Prairie Network.
I'm Ryan Callahan, director of conservation at Meat Eater.
Angela from Axe and Root Homestead.
Chris Helzer, the Nebraska director of science for the Nature Conservancy.
Judd McCullum from Working Class Bowhunter.
Taylor Keene, founder of Sacred Seed.
I'm Ryan Bryson with Bryson Wildlife.
This is Luke Fritch.
This is James Holtz.
Joy Van Weingarten.
Sam Sobel.
Phil Ebert.
Julie Meechan.
And you are listening to the Prairie Farm.
The Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm Podcast.
Prairie Farm Podcast.
Welcome to the Prairie Farm Podcast.
Judd, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, boy. It depends on what age I was. I think when I was about 5 years old, I wanted to be a Tyrannosaurus. I saw Jurassic Park. That turned into wanting to be a paleontologist.
You didn't say, like, man, that thing looks horrifying. You didn't like, I need to stay away from those. You're like, I should be that.
I should be that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was a Tyrannosaurus for a good portion of my childhood. And then I think I just narrowed it down to wanting to be a fisheries biologist all the way through high school and kind of told myself that's what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was never good at chemistry. I could never attach it to anything in my mind. Mm-hmm. So like the way I learn things is, you know, I attach it to something I already know. And I've identified that. And since I didn't have a basis really for anything at that point in my life to attach chemistry to, it's been like a moon to my knowledge that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
And so not being good at chemistry wasn't conducive to getting a degree in the biological sciences. So I kind of escaped college with a non-traditional studies degree. And now I'm doing kind of non-traditional things, I guess.
Yeah, that's why I asked, because I figured there had to be an interesting story there.
Little Judd with like a full beard, 8 year old Joe with a full beard, being like, "I want to tear down barns." Like, of age, you know.
This beard came in when I was about 22, so
Beard
when I was little. It's barely there now.
I'm waiting. Mine's coming. I know it is. Yeah. It's coming.
Yeah,
get the tracking number for it. It's on its way.
Stop eating those $5 chickens from Quickstar.
No, that's probably what's going to do it.
No, yeah, those growth hormones in those chickens.
Yep.
They're going to grow my beard. Thank you, Big Farm.
We're in the business of providing beards to people. Just one of the side benefits of eating our food.
Welcome to Oxy Native Seeds.
Oh man. No, it's great to find that out. You know, I'm the same way. I had a handful of ideas. Really, I wanted to be a farmer, and you know, how that was viewed when we were kids growing up is just like, that's not a possible thing, you know? So it's like, well, what I really want to be, I can't do. And what do I end up doing? You know, and that brings me to this table with Judd and Nick.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad it worked out that way, as I imagine you probably feel the same way.
Oh, yeah.
But your job now is incredibly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You do barn dismantling.
Yep.
Barn reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Barn refurbishing.
Mm-hmm.
Barn repurposing.
Yep.
Anything to do with a really old barn. And you guys get enough business that you can prioritize the really cool ones.
Yes.
And, I mean, we can get more into that here in a little bit. But could you just give us, like, name of the company and just your description of what it is you guys do?
Sure. So the company is Barnstormers Wood. My father-in-law started it in the late 90s. And he's been developing different ways of dealing with different barns ever since. And so we will sell everything from single boards to almost dried in barn frame structures, whether it's a home or a business or whatever anybody wants for it. We've done a couple of party barns this past year or so.
Wow.
It's a lot. That's my elevator pitch, I guess.
Yeah. So does when you guys take down a barn, the wood has to go somewhere. Sometimes it's as simple as get rid of the bad pieces, use the good stuff, rebuild the thing, and mm-hmm. make it nice. And I think you guys did one of those out in Maine recently, right?
Yep.
But I imagine a lot of the wood is like the person, they have no attachment to the thing.
Mm-hmm.
To them, it was maybe even just like it was a, hey, we could probably get some money out of this or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys end up with all this wood.
Yep.
What's the next step then?
So you mentioned not having an attachment. A lot of our customers actually have, the barn has a lot of sentimental value to them, and they don't want to have an excavator come in and just smash and bury it. They want to see that wood get a second life. So, you know, the quality of the wood and the amount of wood kind of factors into how we choose a barn. But then, you know, once we're on site, we've got, there's tons of crazy insurances and stuff. We've got, we rent machines if we travel, if we're working locally within the state or within Iowa, Missouri, we'll truck a couple and work that way. But
what kind of machines are you using? Just excavators?
No, like a man lift, like a Genie man lift. And then a telehandler, Skytrack. We've got a, I think a 42 foot Skytrack at the shop, and we'll rent the biggest ones we can get wherever we go. So, but yeah, we soft strip the barn. We get all the non-structural wood off of it and get the roof off of it, which is what hangs up most people. If you're driving down the road and you see a barn with no siding, we call that a peel and run. Somebody sold the farmer a bill of goods and said, yeah, I'll get rid of that structure for you, and got all the gravy off of it and then disappeared. So that's what's going on there. But yeah, we'll soft strip it and denail everything.
Wait, that stuff's more valuable than like the 6x8s holding up that barn?
A lot of people don't know how to deal with those or have a market for them. Whereas, you know, you can rip down 120 feet of siding and turn that around to somebody in the Home Depot parking lot. You know what I mean? It's just, it's quick money. It's, you know, the pawn shop cheddar, basically. It's if you could picture something going the fastest and making the quickest money.
You would think with like Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace these days, I don't know. Anyway, it's just, that's what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking like, man, those 6x8s sound real nice. You know?
Well, what I wonder is how many of those buildings that could be, there is some repurposing value there for the lumber, just get burned.
Oh, tons of them. Dude. Yeah. Tons of them.
Which is a bummer. I mean, that wood, being 150 years old, would still last longer being put in a building than pine.
Absolutely.
You know, the quick growth
pine. The 150-year-old pine is feels like oak today.
Oh, yeah. You
know, it's wild with the dense growth rings. Is
that long-leaf pine, a lot of that stuff?
It could be. There was so...
Or do they use that mostly for, like, telephone poles and stuff?
They use that for telephone poles anymore. I'm not sure if...
I mean, it's pretty much... Almost, I mean, it's endangered, right? Longleaf pine down in like the Carolinas. And stuff.
I think so.
Yeah, they've replaced them with, what is it, loblolly or something like that. I can't remember the, but yeah, a real slow grower. And I imagine some of those like really old species, like didn't they used to make a lot of stuff out of like cypress wood and, and stuff like that? I mean, you just can't get it anymore.
Well, tulip poplar. Tulip poplar is a big one. Like, we were doing a barn in, gosh, I want to say Indiana or Ohio, and got into some of the beams. And so, well, that's, you know, it's poplar there. And the farmer's like, poplar? No poplar around here. I don't remember if it was Indiana or Ohio, somewhere where there wasn't poplar currently, but had been historically. And so, well, there was. And, you know, so, and that goes back to, the cool thing about a lot of this wood is it's hard to identify, even if you're an arborist today and know your trees today, because it's so different pre-industrial revolution when it grew.
Yeah.
It's completely different color, completely different texture, weight, smells different.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool just to be able to get through all that and learn all that stuff and then see it, all the differences, and then try to compare them to what I know with green lumber today, you know?
Yeah, that's just one of the many, many cool aspects of what it is you're doing. What about lumber dimensions?
It's full cut.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's full cut. A lot of it was, because it might not be common knowledge that as they started moving west and getting into those boreal forest areas and cutting down the pine trees, they wanted to squeeze a few more dollars out. So they started shrinking the dimensions of commercial lumber. So now a 2x4 is what?
One and five eighths
by.
Yep.
Yeah, by 3.5
Yeah,
I think.
something like that.
Yeah, it's not.
It just keeps getting smaller and smaller. Pretty soon they're going to be toothpicks.
Which is crazy because it's also less dense wood.
Much less dense. You might have two or three growth rings in that size of piece of wood.
That you never. I've been dealing with old houses a lot recently, just with what my wife and I do. You never see them on 16 inches. Ever. at least 24 inches, sometimes 30 inches.
Yep.
It's just 2x4s, but they can. So what we did was we were like, well, you know, we got a bunch more wood, but it's crappier, so we just squeeze it closer together. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we end up actually using less wood, you know, like, or if we end up using more wood, or if it's, you know, how efficient it ends up being in the long run.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a fair question. And, you know, it's, again, the same thing that affects every other industry, right? When mm-hmm. you try to make things cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, you can end up with quantity in a faster turnaround time, but quality
mm-hmm.
is hurt now and much more so over the long run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just interesting how those things are always opposite, you know? I'm sure you see that all the time. Let's just start hearing about some of the, I mean, this is going to be a fun podcast. Okay. Like, obviously very educational, but there's some really cool stuff that you guys have done through this. Can you tell a story of the, barn that was made by shipbuilders?
Yep.
In Maine, right?
In Maine. Yep. And, I'd have to look it up. It's a little bit south of Ogunquit, really close to the border with, New Hampshire, I think.
Okay.
And, so we showed up on this property, and this barn was up on a hill overlooking a bay on the ocean. And we got to talking with the owner, whose family was granted this parcel of land by the King of England at some point. I don't think told us when, but so they got this land. They got this barn, which I believe started out down close to the beach and was a livery stable. And then at some point they dragged it up to the location where we found it. And that little chunk of ground with the house that was built in the early 1820s, he parceled off and sold, but he wanted to keep the barn, and he became friends with the new owner, which worked out. And he thought he was just going to skid the barn again about 400 yards onto his property, but the problem was there was a impenetrable swamp in the way and there was no way to get it down the hill, make a right turn and get it back up a hill and get it over all the stone walls to where he wanted it. So, you know, the solution to that was to have it dismantled.
That is crazy.
Which we did. So we got the whole thing soft stripped. We got all the wood off of it, the siding, the stall walls, the granaries and stuff out of the inside, took the roof off, and I got to looking at this frame. And it's hard to describe without visual aids how barns come apart, but I'll say that this one was completely backwards to what we're used to. And there was the tops of the post had bridle joints on them, which we don't usually see. And it took me a good couple of days on the job up there to figure out exactly how we were going to dismantle this, because there were trees around it that the new homeowner didn't want taken down. His wife's favorite tree was right on the corner of the structure. It was probably a 45-foot tall blue spruce. It was the biggest spruce I've ever seen in my life.
That's when Judd figured out I didn't quote high enough for this job.
No, we did all right on it, but we're just sitting there looking at it like we're going to have to take this down one post at a time after we get all the plates off. Man. So that's stuff we usually do on the ground. We'll lay it down in sections called bents with barns here in the Midwest. So width-wise, they have a section with a post, a tie beam running between the posts, and it might have posts in between the exteriors. Wow. And so once you take the top wall plates off, you can lay that bent down and knock it apart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not how this barn was. So we ended up taking all the plates off of it and doing all that joinery separation on the individual posts as it came down.
That's crazy. What was holding the posts into the ground?
They just sit on a sill plate.
Okay.
And 90% of the barns I've ever been in, the sill plate's just about sawdust anyway.
Yeah.
Just from ground contact or insect intrusion or things like that. For some reason, the sill plates just don't ever last. But the post bottoms, you might lose a foot or two off of those, but barns are plenty tall. You can make that up. And, you know, modern building methods, you could put a concrete pier wall under that to regain your height if you really wanted it. So
man,
it's not that big a deal, but yeah, knocking the joinery apart and separating the posts and then flying them down individually, that took a little while longer than we had anticipated, but That's great. It was fun.
What did that feel like undoing work that? Because that thing was put together what 1600s.
It was 1754. I believe is when it was built. And the cool thing was that, like I said, this guy's family had had it the entire time. So he was saying, okay, so these are all the names of my grandfathers and all my relatives that would have been in here. If you can look around on the lumber and see if you can find anything. Well, the first thing we did was I delaminated a piece of trim from the inside of the front door. And behind that was probably a 4x5 business card for the livery stable nailed to one of the beams.
Wow.
And so we separated that and gave it to him. And then the stall walls were double thick. So when I took those apart, I found a painting of one of his, ancestors in a mason's apron. And nice. It was a newer one. It was somewhat modern, but somebody painted it and thought they should drop it down in between those stall walls at some point.
That's crazy.
And then we found other names of his relatives carved into an arched board above one of the horse stalls. And we identified all the names on the list through something we found in the barn. That's
crazy.
Yeah, it was pretty neat.
You might just have to say you can't share, but you haven't shared who this guy is at all. Could you share what a project like that cost? Give a range.
It's usually pretty reasonable. For a normal barn dismantle with tagging, drawings, full set of drawings, ready to go for architectural engineering, I think we charge $38,000.
Okay. What if do you guys ever put it back up?
Yes.
So what if you put it back up?
So we put it back up. It's about the same.
Okay. So it just doubles the price then?
It just doubles the price then. Okay. But in the middle... The middle part is the nebulous thing, and this is where we get into some issues. If people have a really sentimental attachment to the barn and they don't want to see it used, they want to see it go back up as a frame, the middle part of that is the restoration. Mm. And we've gotten into some barns in the past where it has basically come down to doing a full replacement. Mm. Because there was only two posts left, maybe a tie beam left, maybe some of the roof structure, because... You know, they let the roof go too long. The water destroyed the joinery on one whole side of the barn, or there was a bug infestation that wasn't immediately evident. And so that restoration bill, we try to paint a picture of what that's going to look like on site when we've got our hands on the barn.
What do you mean by full replacement? Wouldn't it be cheaper if you're going to use new wood to...
So we still use reclaimed materials.
Oh, okay.
We can still source beams of just about any dimension to replace.
That you guys just have in storage.
Yeah. Oh, so that ain't cheaper wood. That's like 10 times more expensive.
It's reasonable. It's not terrible. But I mean, if somebody really wants to save a barn and they really want to use it, then it's usually not any more than what we charge to dismantle or re-erect.
So do you guys just have like a warehouse full of this old reclaimed wood?
We source it from all over the place.
Okay.
So there's Amish wood yards all over the place. And we've just learned, you know, kind of what their schedule is for how they communicate. Sometimes they've got to go to a central landline in the community to talk to us. And we'll just kind of, we know what time about they get there and you can leave a message with somebody and hope they call you back. Some of them, if the community they live in is a lot more lenient, some of them sneak cell phones into places, or they'll have a neighbor keep a skid steer for them. Things like that.
One of the guys who's that's funny. One of the guys who stood at my wedding with me grew up Amish.
Yep.
And it's just wild way of living, man.
Mm-hmm.
Wild.
Yeah, sometimes enviable.
It is, yeah. Yeah, sometimes it is. We went up to one of the yards in Wisconsin, and at the time, my wife's grandfather had somewhere between 80 and 100 horses.
Really?
And we were looking to find somebody to take them and do something with them. And so... We talked to this Amish guy we deal with a lot, and he said, well, yeah, if you could show me some pictures. So I took my laptop up one day when I was picking up some wood, and I popped it open, and I was starting to pull up pictures, and all of a sudden there was about 15 Amish kids on my back trying to see the screen, glued to me, just weighing me down. And so we went through this series of pictures, and I think he ended up having somebody come get a few of them, but then somebody from Toulon up the road here brought a huge trailer and took three or four loads of them out and left us with probably 10 or 12.
Wow.
So, that's yeah. Crazy. Yeah. They were on a pretty good chunk of ground.
Yeah.
So, it was harrowing to try and deer hunt through there, because if you think dealing with timber cattle's bad, oh my gosh, horses are the worst if they're not broken and, you know, worked with. They're like grizzly bears. Oh,
goodness, dude. They just charge you.
Well, they would line up on you like musk oxen, and they wouldn't want to let you through. Mm-hmm. And so you just kind of walk at them, and you know, if you just kind of steel yourself and you're not afraid, they'll kind of part and you can walk through them. Well, the problem was I couldn't even tell you how many studs and stallions and whatever were out there, but there was one night I was coming out with a climber on my back, and one of them hit that climber and knocked me forward, and I had to stand up real straight and fast, you know, and just keep walking like normal and not act like I was afraid, or that thing was going to probably eat me alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
You know, yeah, and they were all like dark brown and black horses. You just could not see them in the dark.
Yeah.
That is horrifying.
I mean, people think like stuff like that is just the most docile thing, like there's nothing to be afraid of, but when you're standing next to animals that big, it's like, yeah, all it has to do is just decide that it doesn't want me around.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and you're done.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
like cows, same thing, you know. It's just like that thing's 1300 pounds.
Oh, I can't tell you how many times I've been about 4 or 5 steps away from walking right into the side of an Angus bull.
Yeah.
You know, before I turn my headlamp on real fast and go, oop, and divert course.
Oh my goodness,
dude. Yeah,
that would be, I mean, and something else is not only are they 5 times our weight, but we are like the least muscle dense species on earth. Yeah. So like, yeah. So they're really more like 8,000 pounds worth of
they
human.
Might as well be. Yeah. We're just pudding with sticks in it compared to them.
That's right. Yeah. That's
well right. Not Amish people. No. Dude, they got some meat on their bones.
They're solid.
Man.
They're made out of
hands,
spun
every
iron.
Single, every single Amish person I've ever seen's hands are like the strongest hands I've ever seen.
What's left of them? All the ones that I deal with have been in the wood business and around sawmills a lot. So some of them are, you know.
Down to the last few.
Dude, another one of my friends, his family like grew up Mennonite, and him, all of his brothers, his dad, they're all missing some amount of fingers. So all of them. Every single one.
Yep. I thought you were just going to say some amount of finger. Just like, just like,
well, oh, yeah.
This one's shaved back to here. Oh, this one's got most
of it.
Well,
it's Caleb. So he's missing like part of a thumb. I think one of his brothers missing a full finger. His dad's missing a couple fingers.
Caleb,
you know?
Adam?
No, Hosteller.
Oh, Caleb's missing part of a finger?
Oh, yeah, dude.
Really?
Yeah. It grossed me out first time I saw him. I was like, ugh, gross, dude. No, I'm kidding. Caleb's one of my best friends.
It's funny, like, stuff. Nicholas, I'd like you to meet my friend Caleb.
Oh. I was going to shake your hand, but I'll pass. You know, man.
One time I was hiking back after hunting one night, and I was on a permission piece in Illinois, and that guy ran black Angus cows, and there was a skunk, and it was dark. It was a dark night, and I could just barely see the white on the skunk. So I'm trying to like go around the skunk. Well, I end up getting into like the cow pen and to get around the skunk, and the cows kind of got alerted to me being there. And I'm like, I better get on the other side of this fence. Once I got back on the other side of that fence, those cows just took off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just sprinted across the pasture right past me. Mm-hmm. Like a stampede. It's like, man, if I was in there, I'd be flat.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be.
Oh,
yeah.
They're, you know, livestock, they're big, big, dangerous animals. Yeah. But, no. So, going back to this, like, going back to barns, when you're taking apart something like that, what is that feeling that just like, man, I am undoing something that somebody who lived over 200 years ago put together? That's just got to be a weird feeling.
And also, we don't build anything like that anymore.
Nothing like that. So it's a really weird feeling, and I've thought of this for a long time. Like, usually we're on a job for about a week, 10 days, but it seems like time dilates. Like, the last days of the job, when you're just picking up the components and getting them staged to load on a truck, it feels like years have passed. It's like you've released time from the structure. It's such a weird feeling to walk into a standing barn one day, and then a week to 10 days later, it's, you know, a foundation with some scrap wood in it that's ready to burn. That's typically, you know, how we leave stuff, but it's just, it's really strange. It's an odd feeling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're in a way linked to a person that was his part of the, you both had a job to do, right? Mm-hmm. His job was to put it up. Your job was to take it down.
His job was to put it up in such a way that it was never going to come down or come apart.
Right.
So,
and you're linked to him. I mean, like you're the other half.
Yep.
Are there any barns where you think like, oh man, this one hasn't even hit its half life yet?
Oh, sure.
Man.
Oh yeah. There's been a few of those. There was one down by Canton, and these people asked me to come out and take a look at it because they were getting to retirement age, and they wanted to know if I thought that it would stand through their lifetime, through their golden years, or if they were going to have to put a roof on it or do anything to it or spend any money, because if they did, they wanted me to take it down. And I went and looked at it, and it was an absolutely pristine sawn white oak frame. The roof on it was fine. There was no sway back to it. Like you'll see the roof system fail on a barn and the center will start to fall a little bit as the wall plates and rafters splay out from the weight and the time. This one was just as built. And I said, I'll tell you what, it's probably going to take me 5 or 6 years, but I would like to leave this here as it is. And you guys can use it for whatever you want. I'll come back at some point and I'm going to build a house out of it for myself. And about 2 years later, I drove by there and an electrical fire had burned it to the ground.
Oh.
You know, there's things like that kind of happen. So I intentionally try not to like bookmark certain things in my head, because it seems like if I say to myself, oh, I need to go back and take a picture of that, some natural disaster will befall it. And it won't
the universe is like, nah, dude.
Nope.
Wipe it away. You're using pine on your house.
So when you, I imagine a lot of this is barn clean out before barn dismantle, like ancient hay up in the. And I mean, what I've heard that you can get sick from that stuff, like just the mold and dust. And,
I'm sure you can, you know, what is it? Leptospirosis and things like that are always at the top of my mind, but.
How do you remove it? Like, how do you get it
manually?
Out?
But what I'll do is I try to get all the siding off the building and leave the loft in there as much as I can. Oh, so I get a good strong wind blowing through it and just work the wind.
Yeah.
Basically.
That's smart. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got to basically get as much ventilation as possible. My family's got, that was a selfish question. We have our old barn and I've been trying to figure out, cause they put up some hay and, by they, I mean my grandfather when he was like 16. So it's been there.
Yep.
And trying to figure out how to get it out of there, because it'd be nice to restore that barn a little bit. But
is it in bales or is it lump hay?
It's lump hay.
Oh no, that's the worst.
Yeah.
Basically, you got to get in there with a hard rake and rake it from the top.
Okay.
And just get it off the top, because it's so interwoven. You know, even if you jam a pitchfork down there and try to lift it, it's just like, it's like stabbing a pile of blankets.
Right.
Basically, yeah. it's just not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, that's what I'm afraid of. It's like, how do you move it out?
Yeah, I'm probably the only guy my age that's dealt with lump hay more than once.
That's true. I'm pretty sure there's like mountains of old bale twine up there too, you know, just on hanging from the rafters. That's probably a pretty common sight, isn't
it? Yep. There was one that we did that was, there was like a truckload of wire loops from old bales in it. And it was such a pain, because you'd think you got all of them out and then one would trip you. And you'd find, you know, 10 more pounds of it just underneath some other stuff.
And it's all useless at that point, right?
That was actually just wire.
Yeah, so it, you just scrapped it or something?
It wasn't even really worth scrapping. I'm not sure. I think we hauled it off.
Oh, like somewhere. Metal wire.
Metal wire.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking twine for some reason.
No. Yeah, in this one, it was metal wire. We run into a lot of twine, but, you know, it's pretty fairly biodegradable.
What's living in that hay when you get up there?
Raccoons. Always raccoons.
What do you do? Do they ever, like, get feisty with you?
No. I had one in the wood yard the other day that was like right on the edge of being incapacitated by distemper.
Oh, man.
It was just standing right in the middle of the driveway when I pulled in. I was like, that's not a good time for you to be here. And I walked up to it, and it kind of bowed up at me like raccoons do. But then it started to get a little wobbly, and I was like, oh, no. So I had to, you know.
What does that mean?
Put him out.
Give him the eternal slumber.
Yeah.
No, but incapacitated by
distemper.
Distemper is a disease. It's, so when you have a dog, you get rabies distemper.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly how distemper works, but from what I can see how it affects him, it shuts down their nervous system.
Oh, and yeah, yeah.
So I have a video of one on my phone that I found last shed season. It actually looks like it's on fast forward the way that it's like
twitching and stuff.
Twitching and shaking. And it's, you know, it's curled up in a little ball, and it looks healthy with like the fur on its back.
Mm-hmm.
And some of you might want to hit the 15-minute skip ahead button on this, but like when I my dog did a running dive and rolled on it as it was still alive, and so I got the dog off of it.
Oh, nice.
And I flipped it over, and it's everywhere where it's like arm contacted a torso or a leg contacted an arm or anything. It had been laying there so long that it was just bed sores.
Yeah.
We'll put it that way. It was so... And that's how the belly of this one that was in the driveway was the other day. It had been laying down a long time and somehow got up and found its way to where it was standing. And that's probably where it would have just stood there until it died.
Yeah.
It's a strange disease.
Man, it's like CWD for raccoons.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it's basically the same thing.
You've been learning.
Yeah, dude. I'm telling you what, nothing will teach you more than interviewing a lot of experts on stuff that you know nothing about. This is what I do.
Yeah, you're probably like at community college professor level now.
Hey, look, we interviewed a community college professor, and he was awesome.
That's true.
I'm not
taking anything cool away from
him. Oh, you're body slamming community college professors.
I'm just saying
you can't stand them.
Whatever. I'm just saying you're not at Harvard level.
Okay, I didn't realize there were levels. I didn't realize. I don't know. I was trying to ruin Kent's life, as I do.
You always lose.
Yeah. Oh, he's man. A tough opponent.
Kent? Yeah, no, he's not shakable. A couple things about Kent the audience should know, listeners should know. Kent's really stubborn.
I'm so scared.
He's a super stubborn guy in every good and every bad way. He also is really well read. So you're not going to like be like, well, I feel this about it. He's like, but all the sources say otherwise. And he's read the sources and he'll cite the sources. And he's probably emailed back and forth with the expert who wrote that source. So there's some things about Ken. You don't let Ken.
There's another guy in the room that does that even more than I do. I'll just say.
Yeah, Judd. Yes. He's the guy that, you know, so and what's interesting is Judd's not like technically an expert on anything, but he's so well read. He's so interesting. And
well, thanks. I call him an expert on a lot of things. Yeah. He's definitely beyond community college professor on a lot of things.
What? I knew he'd get you, Nick.
I think Chase Burns was a customer of you guys. You guys did a floor for him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Out of some repurposed wood. What goes into that when you guys are going to turn a barn into floorboards?
Okay, so it has to be coming from us. I know some other operations will do flooring out of like spruce pine for stuff like that. I try not to, because even if you put down cardboard and use a dolly and try to move appliances across it, it's gonna leave a mark.
Oh,
it's
man.
Just it's too soft to be soft. A good floor. So yeah.
First my parents used bamboo when they redid their house.
Oh, yeah.
Oh man, it was bad.
Like, was it? That stuff's usually the hardest thing you can get.
Oh my goodness, no. I don't. It was, yeah, it got scratched real bad. And maybe they got cheaper stuff, or mm-hmm. they got like a coat of something over it. I don't know, but mm-hmm. it scratched real bad.
Yeah.
But I didn't know bamboo. I didn't realize bamboo was hard. I thought it was softer.
They do laminate flooring out of bamboo, and it's super, super durable.
No. This is like, not only, it's very obvious that they like compressed bamboo and like glued it together.
Yeah, I think I've seen that stuff before.
It's not like just made out of bamboo. It still looks like bamboo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I think I've seen that. I think my cousin had a floor like that at one time.
I took your spot while you're talking about flooring.
Okay, so it's got to be hardwood. So actually, we're doing a barn here south of town that's all 2x6. I was telling you guys earlier, 2x6 white oak, walnut, and butternut. which is going to be really nice. It's all circle sawn. Mm. It's all full dimension, so I'm going to be able to run it through my resaw and make flooring blanks out of it for our circle sawn floor. So it will send it through a planer and take off some of the high spots, but we leave a lot of those circle saw marks. And even if you plane those off, you'll still get some shadow in the wood from them being there, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
Just denail it all, run it through the resaw.
Denail it. Like you sit there hours and hit it with a hammer to get the nail
down. If I had to pick something I'm really, really good at, it's getting metal out of wood.
Wow.
Like if I had to hang my hat on anything, it's pulling nails out of wood.
Okay. Okay.
You know what?
You ever wreck a blade or something on a missed nail?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I bet that jumps you out of your skin when that happens.
So it wasn't quite hitting a nail, but I reset the blades in my planer one time, and it's an old Powermatic that the people at Powermatic didn't even know they made. It's a direct drive, so the shaft goes right into the motor instead of having a belt or a clutch in between.
Yeah. Sounds dangerous.
It would eat me if I let it. And so I think it's got an 8 or 10 horse motor on it, and when I shut it off, it takes, you know, 8 to 10 minutes for that cutter head to spin down. So
that's some serious RPM.
Why?
So I threw a new set of blades in there. And I can't remember if they were new or if I had had them honed and resharpened, but they had machine oil of some kind on them that I wiped, gave a cursory wiping with a shop towel, and I should have used some mineral spirits or something and really got it off. And there was enough of a coat of lubrication left in there that when I started the planer and after about 10 or 15 minutes of running it, two of those blades slipped out and their hold downs came out at the same time inside the machine. And it sounded like my shop was exploding. That cutter
head. So they were just like banging around?
No, that cutter head stopped right now. Like I've, you know, been around shotguns my entire life. It was like a cannon. It was, if you can imagine something spinning like 6,000 RPMs and then a 24-inch piece of high-carbon steel comes out of it and shatters, and then a 24-inch long piece of softer steel stops it. It was all of that in about a second and a half.
That makes me think of the runaway wind turbine.
Oh, no.
So, I don't know. Well, I'm going to tell it because it's on the podcast. His dad, we were interviewing his dad, and they had a nightmare with their school district. His dad's a superintendent of a wind turbine. Like it was supposed to save them a bunch of money. It ends up being like a endless bucket of money and repairs.
Sure.
Well, at one point they couldn't get the repair company to actually come out. So they had to send
it was a runaway turbine. Like
It was going not quite to about 60 or 70% faster than its max was supposed to be spinning.
Right.
So they sent some random
maintenance guy
up for the school. And it's not like a little wind turbine you get at the it's like a giant one you see on the side of the interstate.
Oh, yeah.
They said some giant guy. And Kent and I were like, wouldn't it be hilarious if that random maintenance guy was like an 85-year-old Henry who was just there to volunteer at the school because he loves the kiddos? They're like, all right, Henry, get on up there. Oh, no. But like, and he had to like wedge a pin in it. Like,
yeah, there's like a safety stop.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to engage that. And I just can't imagine. Maybe who knows? Maybe he waited for like a calm day or something. But he had to. Can you imagine being up in the top of one of those and stopping?
No.
I don't know. Did it just tip over?
The inertia just like takes the thing flying into the distance. It's like, yeah. Well, there goes Henry.
Yeah, I just picture a bolt shearing off. You know, and then he's standing there looking out the open front of the cowling like, whoops.
Please don't fall into the base of what I'm standing.
Henry's just waving down to your dad.
I just can't imagine. So that's what I thought of when you said the planer thing. That's just horrific in both. Anything that's rotating really fast and then it isn't is not good.
Not good at all.
That's how non-chemical explosions happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's a mechanical explosion.
It was a mechanical explosion, but the good thing is this planer was built sometime in the 30s or 40s, and it had a lot of heavy plating around that cutter head. Because if it would have been open, it would have just been a frag grenade, basically.
Yeah,
just shooting shards of... Oh, it was bad.
Have you guys seen those old bridge bombs or the old dam bombs that they used World War II where they bounce on the water for a while. Have you seen that, Ken?
I think so, yeah.
You see the video where the cameraman almost got taken out by it? Like, he's filming it, and they drop it, and it hits something and starts to wobble. And as it does, it starts walking over to the left and coming toward him. And it looks like it goes right over his shoulder in this video.
My goodness,
you know, this old footage.
It's pretty crazy. Scary things that happen.
Yeah.
So you plane it down. You probably have to do some cutting to length, too, I imagine.
What size boards do you typically, like 6 by 36 inch? Or?
So they're not usually, as long as I can get a straight piece out of it, it could be 14, 16 feet long, which I'll then cut down because that's just a nightmare to ship. Mm-hmm. But usually I try to shoot for like 6 to 8 feet.
Okay.
And then
long flooring then. And then they can cut it in the house. And
yeah. I do all the end trimming on it because a lot of the times the ends of the boards, you know, that you take the nails out of, they get a little bit of a flare and they get a little bit of a split and you got to stop that. Yeah. So you trim that off.
So you don't miter it to create a groove, a lock and groove system at all?
Then after it comes back from the kiln, I throw it through our molder and put a tongue and groove on it and back relief. So in all respects, it's just like hardwood flooring you'd buy from anywhere else. Man. It's just got an original face on it.
So is the kiln, is that just any moisture from being out in the elements, mold, insects?
Basically, you're killing mold, you're killing insects, you're killing any algae intrusion there might be there. It's not so much to dry down the wood, because if you were to cut down a tree today and then put it on a slab mill and air dry those slabs, for white oak, it's recommended you dry for 1 year per inch of thickness.
Wow.
So if you consider that all this stuff was milled up at least 60 years ago, you're down to, you know, whatever the average ambient temperature is probably. And at that point, all of the cellular structure of the wood that would hold moisture is kind of degraded.
Yeah.
So it's not green anymore. If it will move, and depending on species, it will move a lot, but we'll kiln dry it down to 12.
What do you mean it'll move?
It moves. Oh, if I dried it down to 12 to 15% like we do, and then you just put it down on the floor, let's say in the wintertime, as it absorbs moisture going into summer, it will just tent.
Yeah.
It'll expand so much that it will just pop apart. It'll pull the nails that you put it down with up out of your floor. There's no stopping it.
How do you deal with that?
So much power. You let it acclimate in the house for as long as you can.
Before use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you carry it in, and I advise the homeowners to turn on their HVAC to whatever it is it's commonly going to be at. And then, you know, expect some growing pains usually in the first year. It might gap a little bit, but usually once it's in the house for a year, it's settled down and it's where it's going to be. So
interesting.
Yeah, it's stuff you don't even think about, but you know, in an old house, what door frame doesn't stick a little bit and what floor doesn't creak and feel a little bumpy and springy.
Yeah.
And
yep.
It's part of it. Yeah.
What does it cost to buy that flooring? You charge per square foot or
it kind of depends on the market.
Oh, okay.
Like if people are more local to us, the price is usually lower. But if you get into urban centers, it goes up. Like we ship a lot of flooring to like Florida, a fair bit to Texas, North and South Carolina. We ship it all over the place. But usually, you know, if it's going to a place where they can't source that kind of wood locally, then we charge a bit more for it.
So if you let's say you get a bunch of planks of wood that you're gonna convert into flooring, what percentage of it gets like tossed or wasted in terms of weight? Or
so that's kind of a hard question to answer, but we usually tell people, just for personal preference, once it gets on site, we advise they order 15 to 20% overage.
But
on,
even
on
like
reclaimed floor,
when you're putting that tongue and groove on it, you know, you're shedding some of it when you're playing in it.
I think if I had a really dead straight, dead flat board, I would only need to take off 3/8 of an inch to create that tongue and groove.
Okay, so really not that much.
It's not a lot, but when you figure that this stuff was sawn green and then nailed up in the barn. Mm-hmm. If they just nailed two ends of a board, then you could probably build a boat out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you're going to have to cut it into two or three different pieces and send it through a straight line rip.
Yeah.
And just straighten it out.
Yeah. So you really are, I mean, you're talking less than 10% of that wood gets tossed or mm-hmm. wasted.
Oh yeah. We try That's to awesome. Save as much cool. of it as we can.
Yeah.
And if it's real junk, it all goes into the wood burner that heats the house and the shop. So get nice. Some British thermal units out of it.
Yeah. You get, like Aldo would say, you get heated twice.
Mm-hmm.
For you guys, probably oh, yeah. three or four times.
Yeah, it depends. I could probably count that up. I bet I get heated at least six times in the process of making a floor
of that firewood. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, by the time I'm done doing a run of flooring, there's probably three or four boards in there that I have named in my head because they just stand out to me somehow. You know?
What are some of those names?
Oh, like Curly. Like if it's got a really curly yeah. grain to it, like, oh, there's Curly. You know,
Curly, meet the planer.
If I get a piece that's like spalted, like, oh, there's that spalted one again, you know. But yeah, I get to know them.
Any like really cool, like, whoa, they used burl wood for this or anything like that?
So, not really. Trying to think if I've ever found anything really wild. I know we had a bunch of redwood left over in the yard from before I worked there. Carl and the guys took down the Isaac Elwood barn in DeKalb, which, you know, Isaac Elwood.
I think I remember you telling me about this when there was a bit of a
side business going on. Yeah, there was a side business going on with that. Yeah, that was that job. But it had a redwood water tank in it.
Huh.
And so I think a lot of that got sold to a kayak maker or somebody somewhere.
That's crazy.
But it was pretty cool. But yeah, that side business, they were blamed for for growing marijuana while they were there. And they had to point out the timeline that's not possible. And the amount of it that was found by the caretaker of this site, they were like, did you ever see us here with tractors and a square baler? Because apparently there were bales of it somewhere. But Carl and the guys got off of that, and it turned out to be the caretaker's son, and it probably sounded like that scene in A Christmas Story called Flick's Mom.
What's striking to me is I think of Castaway,
mm-hmm.
you know, Wilson, you do that, dude. You sound very lonely and insane. You're David the Wood and like, yep. Curly, man, how have you been?
It's how
been
are a while. You? Yeah. If you say more than one sentence, just a board at a time, it's a problem. There's some of them when I'm taking them out of the barn, if they're being stubborn, they get an earful.
Yeah. So we've kind of skipped over. We need to cover this. You're working with your father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Where did he get the idea to do this? Was he always just passionate about old architecture?
So he's a musician.
Okay.
My mother-in-law grew up dealing with antiques. And so she found him on spring break in the U.S. Virgin Islands and carted him back here to Illinois. And he went to work as a prison guard for a while and he was always business minded. He was always trying to do other different things. So he was actually had a company that created the first, what he calls the digital jewel box, which would have been encryption for music files to kind of protect musicians right around, you know, 97, 98, 99.
Hmm.
And so at about the same time, they had been going to flea markets like in Kane County. There was a great big one up there. I think it's still going. And he saw a lot of like barnwood furniture being made. So mm-hmm. he said, you know, I know where I can find barns. I'm going to go get some wood. I'm going to do this. And so he started building barnwood furniture to take to these flea markets. And he eventually ran into a guy who recognized what he was doing. And he said, well, are you just cutting these down with a chainsaw and pulling them over with a truck? And, you know, Carl said, yeah, I thought that was the only thing I could do with him. And he said, well, why don't you come up and, you know, you can hang out with my crew for a little while and we'll show you how to dismantle a barn.
So this random guy was like,
this random guy, an old guy, recognized that, you know, there was a need for this mm-hmm. and there was a need to pass this knowledge on to somebody. And he found, you know, a willing student in Carl and taught him how to do it. And Carl took that torch, and here I am. He taught me how to do it.
So did he take over that business?
He didn't take over that business. He started his own. This was up by Chicago, so this guy was from somewhere in Wisconsin. So it's not like they were going to step on each other's toes at all.
Yeah.
But the guy said, you know, you got to step up to the next level, knock the pins out, separate the joinery so you can put these things back up. That's where the real money's at.
Man.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's cool that he passed it on. I've noticed that, you know, like Carol has been so open and giving to me of, you know, sharing knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Like that hasn't always been the case. You know, my experience, you be around people, they guard their.
Oh yeah. You can't will your knowledge to anybody. You've got to actively pass it on.
Right. Right.
And I've got a good example of that. I got called down to Florida to help process some hewn skins that needed to go into a house pretty fast. And we were doing it on this property that was owned by an old wood guy. And he had a reputation for being kind of a crotchety old fella. And so basically he was mad at me for having all of what he called all this rotten old wood dumped basically on his doorstep at his shop that I had to pull nails out of and get ready to resaw down there. I was saving a client of ours who had tried to use a competitor and got a pretty substandard product. So I pulled his butt out of the fire. But I was inside this guy's shop looking for a rake and a shovel and a broom just to clean up what I was doing. And, you know, he caught me like, what are you doing in here? And I said, well, I was going to try and make it look like I'd never been here. So, you know, maybe I could come back and do this if I ever have to. And he said, well, okay. You know, I kind of won him over a little bit. And then in the front quarter of his shop were all these different kinds of machines like metal lathes and old band saws and all kinds of stuff that he was rehabbing. It was a hobby of him and a buddy of his to rehab these and get them all in working condition and then just basically sell them to get out of the way so that they could do that with other stuff. And I said, are you showing anybody how to do this? I was like, well, what do you mean? It was just me and my buddy that do it. I was like, are you bringing in any kids and showing them how to pull bearings and, you know, recondition metal without damaging it and doing all that stuff? And he was like, well, no, why would I do that? And I was like, so you don't die with what you know. People have to know this.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to do the next generation a huge favor by teaching somebody part of what you know. Otherwise, it's going in the ground with you.
Yeah.
So it's huge for, you know, people to share what they know with people. You know, in this economy we've got, everybody thinks they've got to hold on to their secrets to make all their money and keep it for themselves, but it's just not doing everybody very much good.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's well said. And, you know, as you give people opportunity, it not only passes it on, but it empowers them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's so interesting how many similarities Judd and I have. And one of those is we kind of went to college with a loose plan of what it was we were going to be doing, but we didn't really know what it was going to be. And the right thing found us.
Yep.
And so when you give people an opportunity, you help them, you know, write that chapter in their life of what is it that I'm meant to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that what, you know, there's not much bigger gift you could give to somebody than purpose and,
and,
you know, a skill set that helps them do something meaningful. So, yeah, pretty powerful stuff. Nick does that a lot, actually, with he has a lot of kids in his youth group at his church that he employs. Now, it could be construed to be he makes kids do things he doesn't want to do himself.
Listen, one of the kids, we were just chatting in a youth group, and I was like, oh, how's your job going? And he's like obviously a hardworking, good kid. And I think he was a junior at the time, and he was like, oh, it's going pretty good. And I'm super curious about industry of all kinds. I have no problem asking people what they make. You might run into that when you talk to me. So I was good, like, hey, how much you make? And he's like, oh, $825. I was like, dude, I pay you $15 to come work for me. And dude, you for real? You know, and he's, you know, he's trying to make money. He wants to go to trade school. He's got to pay for it. I'm like, yeah, I'm working on this house right now and need some help. And he was bad at it. You know, he's pretty terrible at
Everybody
it.
Everybody is when they start.
Oh, yeah.
It's important to remember that.
His issue was not that he was bad at it. His issue was that I was bad at it. So he didn't have the teacher. But, you know, I mean, I taught him a lot, but, you know, not near enough of what he needs to know. But, you know, had We had
a hammer by this metal part here. This long stick part coming off, you just drive the nails with.
Well, there was one day we were trying to put gravel, cement under the tub, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "How much water?" I was like, "I don't know." So we mixed water in that 5 gallon bucket for a while. I was like,
They now have a concrete jacuzzi. In the bathroom.
You know what? You know what? One of my strengths is not recording how I once did something. Uh-huh. I had to do concrete again recently. How much water did I put in it? But the point is, I was trying to pass along. Here's what I do try and pass along. I try and convince everyone that I talk to that's younger to add economic value separate from their job, which some people would say is starting a business. but for real, it doesn't have to be a business. You know, just like, hey, could you work for someone on the side? Could you just add value? And I feel like if enough people are adding value, whether through its work or education, like you're talking about, just teaching people these things that they need to know.
Mm-hmm.
My grandma all the time used to be like, if you ever need soap, you combine blank and blank. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what she said, but I should. But she'd tell me this all the time. And my sister finally one time was like really into like something might happen in the United States, you know, soon. So she started listening to my grandma and writing all the stuff down in a book. I was like, good, someone's going to get it. That way, if I need it, I can come to you, you know.
Yeah, that's a real thing, you know, to like have those skills. I think, who did we talk about that with recently? Somebody. We talked about just we need to hang on to those skills. Oh, it's Chase. We're talking about it with Chase.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So, we've done a lot of podcasts in 2 days, man.
This is fun. So it's the Illinois tour. You know, where you stand today, how many states have you guys done projects in?
The company's done projects in 38 states.
Wow. Where do you really want to go yet?
Oh, all the farthest west I've been is Santa Ana, Texas, or that's probably farther west than Valley City, North Dakota. That's about as far west as I've ever been, ever, for anything.
What?
So I want to get farther west than that.
Brother, you look like you were born a man in the Northwest Pacific, you know? Pacific Northwest. Sorry, my brain blanked on that. Dude, that you need to get out there sometime.
I know. That's not the worst brain blank Nick had when referring to the West, the Western Mountains.
The Western Mountains. Oh, yeah, it's a favorite.
Come along, Frodo.
The Great Western Mountains.
The old Western. Look, if you say it confidently enough, someone's like, yeah, I guess they're out in the West, you know?
I mean, you had me sold on it when I heard it. I was like, oh, sure. Yeah, maybe that. Never heard that before.
Look, there's
but okay.
Western Mountains and there's Eastern Mountains, and then there's the Midwest.
The Midwest.
Right between those Western and Eastern Mountains.
And I might look like I'm from there, but I'm a creature of the Midwest. Like, I'm so naive when it comes to dangerous things. Like, we live such a soft and protected existence where we're at. There's nothing venomous or dangerous or anything.
Yeah, I mean, we're supposedly filled with blue-collar workers, but we're the most overweight part of the United States. Well, actually, one of my friends was arguing that the South was like, if it came to average weight per height, you know, it might be the South.
I think your friend might be right. I don't want to make anybody mad, but
But we make snickerdoodle casserole.
Yeah, but we come from tall stock. There's not a person in this room under 6 foot.
That's true.
We just have the height. The people in the South, they're the same exact weight. They're just 6 inches shorter.
Yeah, and that makes a difference on the statistics.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it would
and
be
on the
so,
belt line.
I think it would be so. You know, there's linkage in there. You know, for instance, people who their ancestors started and stayed on the East Coast, they were probably less adventurous than the people whose ancestors started on the East Coast and moved further west. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and that's probably colors their life to this day in some way, you know? And one of the things so my wife is from New England, and when you know, growing up in the Midwest, you're used to eating hot dogs, you're used to eating the occasional TV dinner, pizza rolls, right? And those things exist out there, but like that's kind of like either a very like guilty treat that you have every now and then, or it's straight trash. And you might be straight trash for eating it in their opinion, right? And we call it food snobbery, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is completely a hypothesis on my part, but it seems to relate to that. Like if you were moving west, you were just happy to have something to eat, you mm-hmm. know? Like calories. Yes. You know, whereas if you were in the civilized east, now you have the luxury of being like, nah, I don't want just calories. I want good food. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there's probably like, because those things are not viewed that way here in the Midwest. Like our culture is like, oh, you're having pizza rolls for supper? Yeah, we are too. On Tuesday. Yeah. You know?
Or in the South where they had more cultures than just England, who has like the worst food in the world. They have, they had like the French down in there. They had more Native American input on their food.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know.
Yeah. There's all that stuff, you know, like if you could really take the time to parse it all out and like say, hey, how does this shape how people are in these places even today? I think it'd be fascinating to look into all that.
And if you look at the Southern diet, I think most of that comes from, we're probably going to die of malaria faster than we're going to die of heart disease anyway. So you may as well put five sticks of butter in everything.
That's so true. Yeah. Yeah. That's for sure. Yeah. No, I'm not going there.
Yeah.
I'll it'll be in the after hours.
Might be a hot day podcast. I don't want to know about Kent after hours.
it'll be after this podcast and I'll bring it up to you guys.
Oh man. Speaking of after this podcast, I won't lie to you guys. I am tired and have to use the bathroom so bad.
Well, I want to say one more thing. So obviously this podcast relates a lot to, this interview relates a lot to just ag.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in the repurposing world, like you guys are doing, like that is a huge part. It may not seem like you're a conservation business on the front, you know, people. Obviously Judd here cares a whole lot about conservation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that a business that looks at things and saves them from the landfill, if at all possible, That is a huge step in the right direction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And anytime we can repurpose things, the fact that we use old equipment at Hoxie, you know, old tractors. And
that's so cool.
Yeah. Or like the old planer. This stuff still works.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the alternative? That it just goes and sits in a junkyard somewhere or whatever. I think the fact that we can still make use of that and slow down that, obviously we need new stuff,
mm-hmm.
but not as often as what we demand it.
You know what?
And I think that, you know, what you guys do with Barnstormers, it's just, you know, it really illustrates that.
You know what's kind of a sad deal is the Army Corps of Engineer, when they think of designing things and think about the stuff the Army Corps of Engineers built is in the mid-1900s, maybe the second half of the 1900s. They design it to last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the further our country looks ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that like so sad?
I was just getting ready to say I would much rather use a piece of machinery that could eat me than use a piece of machinery that's going to fail due to some level of planned obsolescence.
Yeah. Oh,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then I don't, because like a lot of Asian countries out on the, specifically the Eastern Asian countries and like Japan, they have like 400 year plans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, isn't that crazy? And we're over here building dams, not expecting our own grandchildren to see them, you know, not buckle under, you know, it's just like, that's wild.
And that is, there's something to be said for those things that last forever, like old barns, you know, it's a special thing and it's good to preserve them and repurpose them, reuse them. What's the best way for people to check your business out if they know of a barn or have a barn?
Barnstormerswood.com and hit that contact button, and that'll go to my father-in-law, and he'll chat you up about the footprint of your barn, the location of the barn, the physical location, and interior and exterior pictures. So if you can have those things ready, if you've got a barn we might be interested in, then fire them over.
Yeah, man. That's awesome. Yeah, so definitely reach out to Judd in that way. You can also follow him just at Judd McCollum, right?
Judd McCollum on Instagram, yep.
Yeah, he's a fun guy to follow. He's got cool stuff to say.
I will warn you that I cuss like a sailor, and I feel like a filthy pirate around these two sweet angels I'm sitting here with. But just as long as you know that, come give me a follow.
We love Judd for who he is.
Also, if you're in Illinois, And you need CRP seed or backyard prairie seed or food plot seed, native food plot seed to be specific. Judd does a lot of dealings with seed, and you'll buy it from him the same price you'd buy it from us. Mm-hmm. He deals with us and works out here in Illinois. So if you're looking for some of that, give him a, shout.
Definitely.
Be happy to help you out.
Yeah. And Judd will, if at all possible, he'll probably want to take a look too at what you got going on if you're unsure on something, because mm-hmm. he wants to make it work right for you.
I'd rather you have the outcome you want than put money in my pocket. So that's the most important thing to me, is creating habitat and
love it,
advancing conservation.
Love it.
Absolutely. Well, all this started with an idea for Judd's father-in-law. The idea's been passed on to him. Same thing with every bit of conservation work that we do at Hoxie, which this podcast is presented by Hoxie Native Seeds. But hopefully you get your own conservation ideas that you can pass on to the people in your life, the people that you have influence with, because that's how this all grows. Because conservation happens one mind at a time.